Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, the immaculate. Now listen to this, I'll tell you about the heartache. I'll tell you about the heartache and the loss of God. I'll tell you about the hopeless night, the meager food for soul for God. I'll tell you about the maiden with wrought iron soul.
And to get this show started, we need a little Huey. Welcome to a final edition for 2009 of Soma Time. I'm your host, Dr. Mark. I'm going to call to participate. Oh, next year, can we please get a little audience participation? The number is 646-478-4847. 646-478-4847. Number to call to whine, opine. Or somewhat, I don't know, whatever rhymes with opine. Anyway, it's going to be one of those nights, folks. I've had one of those days. I'm a little bit behind in my assessment of it, though. I have to go back to figure out what happened. Oh, that's right. We spent the day at the hospital with, as Batman has articulated many times this year,
you filthy criminals.
That's right. The allopaths were on the Appalachian Trail today. My boy, otherwise known as the son, the boy, the Kyle, was there for a routine MRI of his heart. Now, you don't know his history. I'll explain real quick. He was born with holes in his heart and 15 years ago, actually, in January 13th, so we're almost there. And today was supposed to be just one of those routine little look-sees to see the progress of his repair and get ready for next year. But son has a history, and histories tend to rise up when you stick drugs in people, which is what happened today. So when they put a little too much juice in the old anesthesia, Kyle went from 100% saturation of his lungs to 50. The Ambu bag came out, the little buzzer went off, we had to run back in. So the MRI was postponed in favor of, blood gases and an echo at the bedside. And 5 hours later, we left the hospital knowing nothing about the function of his heart other than the fact that he could withstand the allopathic, meat grinder. And this kind of is a punctuation point, if you will, for the entire second half of 2009. As we began last week's show talking about how we got to this point in the whole healthcare debut and what's going to happen going forward into next year. So I guess I got a little bit of a vignette this morning over there at Westchester Medical. The lovely and talented people over there at Westchester Medical who, for some reason, were more concerned about their liability than what they were actually trying to get out of my kid's ticker today. So, if you had a similar adventure with the allopathia this year, some type of adverse drug reaction, which happens very often, or maybe a misdiagnosis, or maybe you took one of those lovely medications that had to, to be pulled from the market, or you had a little swine fever take over your family for a while, a little Tamiflu for you,
give me a call.
Give me a call over here as soon as you can, and we will pop you up and get your story. So with that as the backdrop, I will entertain some calls. Let's see, this is a 610 area code. 610, if you're there to ask a question, I will put you on the air. If you're just there to listen, we'll find out. I don't know. Maybe you're one of my guests. I don't know. This is one of those nights. So let's see. You're on the air with Dr. Mark on Summertime. Go ahead now, if you can. Hello? 610, you there? Where are you listening? I love this. A montage of me talking to myself. Are you there listening, 610, or you have a question to ask?
Hey there, Mark.
Hey, who's this?
Mark.
Yes.
All right, this is Dr. Jeff. Actually, a chiropractor, just like yourself.
Oh, okay, Dr. Jeff.
Just hopped on the line because I happened to listen to you speaking on the On Purpose program not too long ago. Just hopped on, wanted to hear what you had to say. Just wanted to listen out there.
Oh, okay,
so,
man. I'll let you keep listening. But what part of the country are you practicing in?
Right in Oaks, Pennsylvania, right near Philadelphia.
Philadelphia? Oh, God. The city of disdain for the Giant fans for me, anyway. The Flyers are kicking my Rangers butt tonight as I'm watching this debacle here. So your sports teams make me nuts. Good schools down there and stuff, but, can't complain too much. All right, tune in, because I got lots of stuff to spill tonight, so feel free to hop in the chat room if you want. We keep going over there, and I'll open that up now, and want to go back and forth, exchange emails, whatnot, I'd be happy to oblige. I'm feeling a little saucy tonight, so it could get a little ugly up here. But thanks for tuning in, and I'll keep you going. I'll let you go back to listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
Okay. So let's see if that, oops, I don't know how I do this now. Yep, there he goes. All right, so Dr. Jeff tuning in. Thanks. I'm getting like a little speckling of these chiropractors now that you know, they rediscovered the Philippi, because I'm such an outlaw with the profession. It's, I don't know what to make of that. Do I tell them what I know, or do I just know what I know? Because sometimes in chiropractic, what you know can get you in a lot of freaking trouble. So anyway, back to my little recap of what we did last week. If you remember back, first part of the year, I was talking about how the rise of social media became the new template. And we went to the TMZ culture, gossip, rumor, innuendo, scratchy scratch. And you look at what's gone on in the last 6 months in terms of the way information, which we'll just call it that, got moved out politically around healthcare, around the swine fear, and around a whole bunch of other issues that we're going to cover tonight. And how that shaped public opinion, as getting tweeted and popped around, and how ultimately it kind of led us to where we are right now, which is where we have this somewhat interactive conversation going on with some of the people that make some of the little decisions, but for the most part, it's all phony. Because if it was real, things would be happening that would have real results. And what we get is a lot of piecemeal. We get a lot of icing and no cake. So look at that first part of the year again and understand it as the waveform that we talk about all the time here on the show. You always start off in a valley. It's like a learning curve thing, right? You start off unconscious, incompetence. You don't know what you don't know. That's that exosomatic phase where you have the utopian vision of, oh, we're going to, you know, think about a year ago when Obama was, oh, change is coming to town. Everybody's all excited because it just means something different is going to happen, right? You push through the fear of things getting different, and then all of a sudden, wow, there's really a lot of freaking work to do here. And, you know, you saw Obama go, holy mackerel, look at the mess they left me. All right? So that exo phase is utopian, but it also signifies that there's going to be a new platform. We do this every winter because it's nature, right? Nature digs deep and says, okay, we're going to go in, we're going to do a little R&D, we're going to come out. It's just like the off-season, you know, hot stove in baseball. No games going on. Everything's happening behind the curtain, behind the scenes, and we're retooling. Mets signed Jason Bay. All right, they need a pitcher. Okay, and it plots along. So there's not a lot of. By the way, I just opened the chat room. If anybody wants to hop in there and talk to me during the show, ask any questions you have, because sometimes you can't dial in because you're driving on the West Coast. And what happened those first 3 months is that the social media outpaced the old media. And then you had all of the old media, newspapers and television people, and all, everybody's tweeting, everybody's on the Facebook, right? Now, all of a sudden, Google comes in, swoop, and it says, you know what? You guys need to personalize this. Remember we did this with AOL? Well, we're going to put a little name after your Facebook page. And now your Facebook page is your home page, and everybody's happy. Well, now Facebook, which was a little social media circle, now becomes accessible to the big, bad Internet, which means now you've got to deal with spam and hacking and all kinds of all the usual things of the big city. While that's going on, we got revolutions in Iran. We got all kinds of things going on. So that first 3 months of the year led to the things we dealt with in the second 3 months of the year, which is that was now all our feelings, remember, emotion, traveling over digital wires creates a little bit of friction. Now we have, is the technology shaping the human, or is the human shaping the technology? And, of course, the punctuation point of that was Michael Jackson's dirt nap, because that led to, what, 75 different lawsuits, 400 different, you know, specials and investigations and all that stuff. And it led to a summer of disdain. Disdain for the sake of disdain. Just craziness out there. People just complaining to complain, actually. Because they could, because now someone can hear them. Ooh, you hear me. And we went kind of back and forth with that. And we talked about it on the show as the guests kept going from dealing with the individual to dealing with society. If you look at the oscillation of the guest list, went over it last week, we saw that that was the theme. How do we deal with being an individual in this very open, very interactive society that's always probing, always categorizing, always trying to tailor itself to our preferences and kind of lure us in, make us a little drunk on our own deal. We're going to design our own page, and Google's going to make our background and everything becomes carrot and stick. Okay? Real simple. So as I meander here, we get to the point where we're at the summer, and now healthcare is becoming the big issue. Why? The media decided that, right? And Obama said, yes, now we're going to solve healthcare. We've already dealt with war and economy, cash for clunkers, all that stuff. So now we're going to go and take all the stimulus stuff and we're going to chuck it at healthcare. Why not? It's the summer. So we sent the senators home, and they had their little deal for they had their little recess. And for the most part, you know, we got a lot of feelings out and expressed, but not a lot of change for change's sake, you know, going on in terms of the actual bill. We couldn't get a bill. Everyone just kept arguing, right? So I got to play this clip. Let's see if I can get here while I'm doing 20 things at once. Put in the magic password. Whoops. All right, let's try that again, Flippy. Boop, 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 boop. Bastard. Oh, yeah, Flippy's drunk with stress. Okay. Bip. And we had basically, if you watched any of the news over the summer with all these things, these town hall meetings came up and the teabaggers and all that. But the best moment of the whole summer was good old Barney Frank, you know, the consummate, you know, the just war-torn politico who's got more skeletons in the closet than you can possibly imagine if you watch Michael Moore's movie. All these guys do. Every last one of them, just a bunch of shills. You want to just take a shower when you see him on TV. But this was actually one of those moments where I kind of burst out laughing. This is an interaction between two extremes that have no intention to communicate. And if you're into some of the stuff we talk about in terms of the four domains here, we have Barney Frank, the consummate eco that likes to onto, which means he's an emotionally communicative guy that likes to communicate his beliefs. And then we have his partner in crime and in this little YouTube clip, who is a philo who's trying desperately to exo. So is there someone that bonds who's trying to communicate this utopian vision and is using language that gets Congressman Frank a little upset? All right, so here we go. A little Barney Frank to get us started.
Moments ago, Senator,
first of all, Larry King
of Massachusetts wrapped up a town hall meeting on healthcare in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Watch this.
Here we go. Yeah, watch this. You watch it, I'll listen.
Why do you continue to support a Nazi policy as Obama has expressly supporting this policy. Why are you supporting it?
When you ask me that question, I am going to revert to my ethnic heritage and answer your question with a question. On what planet do you spend most of your time? Do you want me to answer the question? Yes. As you stand there with a picture of the president, the face to look like Hitler, and compare the effort to increase health care to the Nazis, my answer to you is, as I said before, it is a tribute to the First Amendment that this kind of vile, contemptible nonsense is so freely propagated. Ma'am, trying to have a conversation with you would be like trying to argue with a dining room table. I have no interest in doing it.
There you go. Little Barney to get us going. So anyway, if you could possibly take that as a little encapsulation. I swear I'm going to punch this thing in the nose. A little encapsulation of what went down this summer in terms of the healthcare, town hall meetings, is that you had a bunch of people that were rallying around this, we don't want the government taking over our healthcare stance, and then you had a bunch of bought and sold, basically shills for both the drug companies and the insurance companies defending their turf. And no resolution. Oh, we can't get an agreement. What a surprise. So the confusion just kept mounting. And that's that ontosomatic self-referencing, I don't recognize the other person's point of view domain, which happens to be the one that is propagated every damn summer. Grass grows individually. Corn comes up. Everything becomes individuated. It peaks in the summer. So the fact that we were even going to attempt to get consensus agreement or any kind of an interaction going was stupid. But we don't know about the wave and we don't know anything about the stuff. So anyway, that was where we kind of started. And looking at the guest list, this is where the undertow was. Remember, if you're thinking about it as a waveform, starts in the valley in the winter, up, rises up in the spring and the summer, that's the phylosomatic aspect of things. Things are growing and changing and developing just like little babies grow. Then it becomes ontosomatic. It becomes individuated and dominant and mine. And that's the summer, right? Now, that's the seasonal aspect of it. Then you come down the water slide in the fall and everything dies off that isn't supposed to be alive and you go back through making a new wave for the next year. Now, what happened was because we front-loaded everything with social media, propagated it through the culture, and took everything and TMZ'd it up into the sky with Michael Jackson, we made Gossip King, right? The geeks went nuts trying to give us more tools to communicate, Bluetooth this, everything. We just kept cluster-repping across the culture. Then we said, you know what? Let's have a meeting. And then we did nothing but just shoot darts at each other for 3 or 4 months, all the way through into the fall when, of course, school bells ring, and it was time for swine fear. And if you look at our guest list, as we're going to go through here in a couple minutes, it really reflected what was the underlying chasm between the two different extremes here that were being debated. Is that you, of course, on one hand, you had the woo. And the woo represented a lot of different things, a lot of different types of woo going on here. There was a religious woo and a political woo and a conspiracy theory woo, but basically the non-traditional view of things was going on there, right? And once that became the big deal, was what woo are you with? We figured out pretty fast that, for the most part, that type of politics, whether it be Sarah Palin's extreme or whether it be the Appalachian Trail guy, or all these different factions, had no cohesion. And they really are not supposed to, because what's woo supposed to be? It's woo for you, not woo for me. It's your personal truth. But we try to make it into this political statement. We try to make it into something that's a platform. And it's wet sand. It won't carry. All that went up against the big machine, the moo. Now, the moo is most of us. The moo is under the glory of the bell curve. We have strength in numbers. And the moo is also the establishment. The moo is also the status quo. Doesn't want change, resist change, bureaucracy, blue, red, all kinds of tape, right? So these two things were oscillating back and forth. So you look at our guest list, just starting in July, we had Arlene Taylor come on talking about your brain design. Now, here's something that never comes up in education, even though we've done 20, 34, almost 40 years of research on brain development. We never apply it to education. She was applying it on that episode back on July 1st, mostly to how to recognize your strengths and understand that this is the way, if you align your lifestyle with these, with what your brain's natural abilities are, again, natural, ooh, with no drugs allowed, no, just natural. You do it naturally, developmentally. These are your affinities. Life gets smoother, less stress, but what do? We box everybody up, bell curve it up, and we end up kind of putting a square peg in a round hole a lot, and then, oh, wow, people get dysfunctional. David Goodman, who hopefully will join us at some point in the program, he came on the following week and represented the moo side of this and talked about the bureaucracy that was really undermined a lot of the brain research that went on since the 60s and talked about a cultural lobotomy that was propagated through the hallways of such organizations as NIH and how they went from mental health to mental illness in their whole agenda in the 60s. And then we talked about, what happened with vaccines and what happened with the FDA, with the stuff they put in the food supply, and it was a yada-yada discussion back on July 8th. Check that freaking episode out if you want your hair to curl, right? Then back to the moo. John Murray comes on. He is also a chiropractor out on the West Coast, but he's an LA healer. And he came on and talked about astrology and how that relates to relationships. Pretty woo stuff, right? You know, my woos and woos. And we kept going woo. We had Samuel and Linda Gross-Bonder on talking about heart gazing. Again, making the emphasis about the biological interaction of living systems, human to human, heart to heart, energy fields. Really, really far out stuff that they can't stick in a health care bill. Yet, the social stress that we experience on a daily basis has a lot of woo to it because we put meaning to things in this life. We don't just put, codes and stuff up on it. And then we finished up July with Tommy Major from the band Entrain. Great episode. He's a musician, a career musician, talking about entrainment, a very moo concept, all right, that's in physics and it's in engineering and it's in all these different things. And here he is applying it to music and applying it to peace, applying it to getting groups of people to experience it physically so then they can communicate it personally and using their words, using your word pictures. So that was July. August hit. This is when all those funky debates started. And we kept going. Oh, circle back. John Murray, July 15th. My bad. He's a sports psychologist. He's on the moose side. Look at the list here. Craig Martin, August 5th, he's the astrologer, L.A. healer. John Murray's a sports psychologist. So he was a moo. So keeping score at home. Arlene Taylor, we will look at her as being actually quite moo, even though she's woo. David Goodman, representing the moo, but very, very woo. John Murray, he's moo. Samuel Linder, oh, they're woo. And Tommy is also a woo with a moo message. Mixed, mixed, mixed. Craig Martin coming in August, okay? He was the L.A. healer chiropractor guy. Sorry about that, John. And he came on and talked about relationships and archetypes and things like that and how that led him from dealing with chiropractic in the physical sense to dealing with astrology in the metaphysical sense. Very, very, very woo, but good stuff. Contrast that, the following week, Ray Petras comes on, very, very moo, talking about pain and how we can self-regulate our own pain thresholds. Pretty cool stuff. Very moo. But also for the rank and file, a little radical. Then we had old Affelter on, chiropractor out there, and he wrote a bunch of really cool books about the healthcare system, two e-books, Robert Affelter. Check it out. The episode was back on August 19th. And basically what he was saying was a lot of the concepts of disease and science behind this healthcare reform are just based on economics. Straight old money run. Good stuff. I'm telling you, read his books. Led us to another guy who straddles the line between the moo and the woo, Dave Licani, business guy, wrote a book about how to sell when nobody's buying, which was really kind of apropos of everything that's going on. We have to learn to not let money run our ideas and let our ideas have value in and of themselves and let that be the worth they have, not put a price tag on all this stuff, because that's what's happened in healthcare. We've put a price tag on just about everything that's out there. So that gets us through August, right? Now, last month of the summer, September, this is when I told you, the creeping specter of swine fear came in because the kiddies went back to school. And I don't know what's going on. Got all kinds of things happening here. So now we're into September, right? We have Tom Vanderbilt on, finally, about traffic. Now, this book, I swear, it's still sitting on my desk over here in a pile here. This book has so much information in it, it'll make your hair hurt. And the interview made everything else hurt, actually. Me and Tom had a tough time with the Skype. But you can kind of hear us. Read his book now, in the winter, when you're sitting there, and look at what's going on in terms of Homeland Security with the planes, and all the stuff with the satellites, watching the cars, and the license plates, all the things that are happening that are very, very kind of creepy, and all the dynamics that go on with traffic, especially now dealing with the holidays and travel and staycations and all these words that just got into the culture in the last 6 months because social media made everybody's local environment global. Tom really gets indirectly into that in his book. The book is just fascinating how traffic is a reflection of our social behavior and how we drive and how we experience the act of the physical act of driving. Great book. Gets into a little of the neurology of it. I don't know. I read several books this year. That blew me away. And then Michael Lowe's came on. This is when we start getting into the swine fear a little bit. Now, Michael's a guy that does a lot of the functional medicine stuff out west, and he talked about, you know, the immune system and how to get your immune system basically to function with high integrity. Again, natural stuff. He's a die-in-the-wool moo who went woo in his career and started realizing that, you know what, I don't want to pour all this garbage into people the rest of their lives. I want to teach them how to live well. So he did a show about that with me. Piggyback that on the fancy Sam Gosling coming on from, you know, down in Texas. And he came on and talked about the social aspect of what's happening on the web and how that affects us. And he has a whole concept of called snooping. I love this. These guys make up these words. How come I can't make up a damn word? People will stick with it. It's called snooping. And his whole thing about snooping is how your physical stuff, the stuff in your life, says things about your personality. Now, he's taken that concept and applied it to your Facebook profile. And there's a whole website that basically deals with, does what you put on Facebook really, the image that you project out there, is that really you? And gives people a chance to guess things about you with his personality test using the whole oceans concept that's big in psychology, the big five, as they call it. And if you want to know what that is, listen to the show. I'm trying to get archive hits tonight, guys. This is a total, you know, just a run to get you to listen back. September 16th, great show with Sam Gosling. Again, there's another moo concept that's trying to get into the woo of this interactivity between all this down here on the ground and all this technology flying over us, which cultivates and personifies and goes into freaking stratospheric levels. September 23rd, 2009, the great and powerful Gary Vaynerchuk came on these airwaves and patted himself on the back and us on the head at the same time. Did a great job. Gary did a great job. Wine Library TV dude, a complete and total entrepreneur from the get-go, and gave us his message of passion, his message of peace, and talked about crushing it, his book Crush It. Why now is the time to cash in on your passion? So if you want to go from July to September 23rd and go dun da da dun 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 da da dun dun to Gary, there you go. Gary's show was scary for me. Gary's scary. Because A, it was featured on the network, and B, there was a lot of people in the room that wanted to talk to Gary that night because he's a popular dude. He's a philo. So here we have a philo beto, a bonder in our language. If you don't know what I'm talking about when I mention these four freaking words, go to the site, somaspace.org, click on Meet the Four Domains, and it talks about how these biological perspectives become our sort of our neurological base to develop all the other behaviors that come after it. And they're just orientations that allow us to develop these whole big, complex neurological profiles. So, enough said about that. Gary's a philo, which means he naturally bonds with others and seeks to get that. This is where he gets his clarity from. It's his source of coherence. So Gary's show was a little bit, you know, intense for me because I had to deal with the fact that the message he was giving out about personal branding, always in, from a belief system perspective, was basically antithetical to what I'm about. But I was more curious about how he could read other people and meet their needs selling basically wine on the Internet. All right, which gets us to the end of the summer. And Natalie Curlo, a chiropractor from down south, who came on talking about vitalism. Again, back to the swine fear. What do you do to naturally boost your immune system? So that got us right to the cutoff and got us into the fall. Okay? So once we got to this point, we're now we're at the peak of the wave coming down. This is when all the fallout begins. And so, you know, I'll kind of take a little pull over and check the map here now and give you guys a little tease. Put together a little web letter, a little woo wisdom web letter you can tune into every week called OVI, of vital interest. Just go to my site, summerspace.org, and you'll see the big OVI sign-up sheet there. And what that thing does is once a week, I used to, for 5 years used to, once a week, sit here on a Sunday afternoon and put together what's called Wavelengths, which is an old local newsletter thing I did for my list of clients and former colleagues and all that. It just kind of spewed over the stuff. And over the last 2 or 3 years, I actually got sick of doing that, so I sent them out, like, here's a bunch of links and sent them all over the place. And then I put it on Blog Soma, which is still over there, blogsoma.net, as our resource blog. They previewed these shows and did other things, and I would pepper in other interviews I did and things like that. I got sick of all that 1 week, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to what I was doing 10 years ago, which was talking about vitalism, because this freaking virus, this H1N1, was dominating the conversation, scaring the bejesus out of people. So I went and did a little lecture at my daughter's grade school, eighth grade, back there around that time. And I just got really kind of like down to the nook and cranny of it. I asked these kids about, you know, all told about maybe 90 of them in three different classes, are you more afraid of getting the swine flu or are you more afraid of getting the swine flu vaccine? It was equal amounts. Now, that's a function of getting so much information you can't process and shutting down, teaching you nothing about your own natural immunity, teaching you nothing about how to regulate your own body. Everything was about the environment is scary, scary, scary. And that's where we get into the fall. And all these memes, these ideas, started to crawl into people's heads, and we started getting some pretty funky behavior out of it, right? So register, go sign up for OVI. Once a week we send it out. It has a whole bunch of things on there to give you some strategies to deal with all the social stress. And so you can catch that over at summerspace.org. This week, if you register this week before New Year's Eve, you'll get my free natural remedy for hangovers. Ooh, wouldn't that be nice and juicy this week? Because you know what? I'm even hitting the sauce as we speak. It's one of those days, man. Spend 5 hours in a hospital with a foobarred MRI with your kid? Yeah, you're going to want the rum. And get one of these out of it.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
All right, so without further ado, as we make our turn at the head of the clubhouse turn here for the fall, going over these shows, we are joined by one of our guests from the fall. I think this is him. And let's see if he hears me. Is that you, Doug? Hello, Doug.
No, this is David Goodman.
Oh, my God, it's David. Oh, wow, the trumpets blare. I see all the ones. Okay, I thought it was him. David, go. All right, wow, I didn't know you were joining us. All right, I got to make it a little Elvis rules for you.
I'm the king. And number two is
look out, man.
That's it. All right, David Goodman surprised me there. Joining us from California, where I just was. I was just out in San Diego not too long ago for like a day and a half.
Good for you.
You're up the coast there. And what's the name of the town you're up in? Endocino or something like that?
No, Escondido.
Escondido. It always sounds like food when you say it. I don't know why.
Yeah, it abuts San Diego.
Wow, okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I've been going so fast here that this is something that you could probably slow my pace down about from you know, 97 to back to 33 or something. Is that from your perspective as a brain researcher and a kind of a cultural critic, what do you think the lasting effects of not so much the vaccine, but the entire propaganda around the swine flu, the H1N1, and the fallout of it this year is going to have going forward on the culture? Are they going to be able to scare us as easily next year with the next big bug, or have they really done some systemic damage to our psyche collectively?
Well, the way I look at it is it's Herr Goebbels, it's the collapse of the German Reich in December 1944, it was clear that Hitler had taken on much too many enemies, you know, American Britain on the left and the Free French, and of course, on the other side, the Soviet Union. So Goebbels got on the air and he talked about all the secret weapons that Hitler was developing that would turn the war around, you know, implying that we had some kind of atomic bomb or whatever. I've read extensively in his brilliant propaganda. That's who we are now. We're going to be defeated, I gather. And all this propaganda is a bunch of crap, and people are beginning to understand it, but they also are seeing our doom inevitable because the Christians have been turned into apocalyptics. We got 2012 for being prepared for the next terrorist attack. So I think people are doing two things. They're tuning it out, obviously, to what the newspapers are saying and all those canned headlines that are sent to them from Washington, D.C. and places in Virginia. And they're also prisoners of their own educational system, of their own expectations, just like the Germans were in December 1944. So I think this is the worst of times and the best of times, to quote the first line in A Tale of Two Cities. That's my opinion.
Wow. So you think that this in some way gets people to wake up, and in other ways it takes those that were already comatose into a coma, and they'll just shut down and depend on the system even more? Because what I saw was two different directions happening early on in this, and we'll get into some of the guests that came on to share with us, is that some people took this as an individual battle. They took it on within their family, within themselves, and they literally took it on as it relates just to them. And some people took it more as a political thing and took it more as an overarching type of a thing, and they would get more active and more community organized, to coin a phrase, and they were much more interested in why the system was so unresponsive to them rather than them individually rejecting or accepting what it offered them. So I just saw such a disparity of responses that, and again, it was reflected in the guest list of how we were going to approach this problem, because once the WHO, in its infinite wisdom, declared this a level 6 pandemic, when there wasn't a lot going on, and the southern hemisphere had already had their flu season, and it seemed milder than the seasonal flu, the production of all the vaccines and all the fast tracking of all these things seemed much, much more like their real agenda, which was to cash in on us, seemed very much exposed, and that's why people were rejecting this thing. And then they were going to force the nurses here in New York State to mandate the vaccines, and they went to Albany and protested and got it, and the powers that be, which you know more than me, they went, you know what? You know, if we mandate it, then we're liable. So we're just going to strongly suggest it. And they backed off. And then they were opening up all these places to dispense all the vaccines that came over, and nobody showed up. So it was funny. It was like, what if you had a pandemic and nobody came? So it's like nobody wanted to participate in it. And I thought that was actually kind of a good thing that social media was out there, you know, giving information that wasn't coming over the airwaves. And then, I don't know if you tracked it as much as we did here on the show, then this plague broke out in the Ukraine, in Kiev, right around the time that they shot those DEA agents in the northern part of Afghanistan when they were going to ruin the poppy seed crop as a way to get back at the drug-run culture over there and the government over there. And the laboratory that was implicated was good old Baxter Labs, makers of H1N1 vaccine.
There you go. Yeah.
And it was like we just went through such a list of people. And we started off with Barbara Lowe Fisher, who maybe you heard of from the National Vaccine Information Center. And she talked about the fact that if you just apply their own allopathic standards to this, the science wasn't there, the safety wasn't there, the information wasn't there. And again, Tamiflu was proved to be a complete and total joke, and now they're fishing out almost a million of these vaccine doses that have no effect at all. They would look at Atlanta, 800,000 of them, and they just found a whole bunch more. So the establishment, the MU as I call it, the herd, was getting a little restless because
Papa Bear government was screwing things up, and they were doing it by design. It was like, we're going to go one step at a time. We had Steve Siskold on in October talking about, you know what, if you just get more awareness of what he called your body's intelligence, your BQ, he called it. If you had a high BQ, you'd never line up for one of these things and be a sheeple. But most of us are so tuned out to kinesthetic awareness, and you've got some history with this with your work with all the guys that deal with what the heck's it called? The name's escaped me. The guy up
the
in L.A. that what's his name?
The Chronomics? No.
No. The other guy that you contributed to his book a couple of years ago, the guy that did the Primal Scream, Primal Healing, that guy.
Oh, Arthur Janov, yeah.
Arthur Janov. You talked about it on our show back in the summer, that the third stage of frontal lobe development deals with this emotional intelligence, being able to laugh or cry at a peak to get past the old patterns. And most of us are taught to suppress those extreme emotions and never use them to promote any type of proactive behavior, because it's looked at as being socially untoward. So we don't want to see that. And definitely not in a situation where someone's overcoming a crisis or trying to work through something that's deeply embedded in their system. We have drugs for that. So it's like, well, actually, this is the perfect time to play this little clip from I just pulled off YouTube a little while ago. Back during the healthcare debates earlier this month, Senator Dorgan from North Dakota was talking about, he was reading the transcript of some of the popular drugs like Fomax and some of the other drugs that are out there that paint this picture of an idyllic environment if you just, popped our pills. Here's a little clip from his he read on the Senate floor here.
Go ask your doctor if the purple pill is right for you. They don't have the foggiest idea what a purple pill is for. They just think, with all these scenes of trees and green grass and convertible cars and pillow clouds in the sky, if life is like that when you're on the purple pill, give me some purple pills. I mean, that's what this advertising is all about.
And, you as someone who's operated on both the scientific side and also someone who understands what these guys are really about, what do you see when you see a Lunesta ad or a Flomax ad, on TV painting this picture for people and then always, tagging it with ask your doctor, as if the doctor who sits there and literally has the, the little cute little drug bunnies come in and give them samples. Is this not any different than what happens, a couple of miles down the road in the inner city where we have the dealer, the pusher, and the user? Isn't it the same basic template?
Well, it sounds like you're suffering from future shock like Alvin Toffler one again.
I'm suffering. Is there a drug?
You're just overwhelmed by all these problems concatenating in your head. The pharmaceutical industry last year reached an endowment of $1 trillion. This morning I was reading a book called Blank Spots, that the government of the United States has 1.8 million civilian workers. But Black Ops in the United States employs 4 million people. Can you understand that? That 2 out of 3 people getting government money don't tell you the truth?
Wow.
So take the pharmaceutical industry, which is now exploding into China. I never thought that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're unstoppable. The black operations, the lies, deceit that are fed to the media are straight out of Goebbels' pen in Germany. He was a magnificent propagandist. What Goebbels did, and this is what we're experiencing right now, is that everything published and spoken in Germany had to be cleared by his office, by his propaganda ministry. So the result is that if you published a pamphlet that did not abide by the party line, you could be arrested and tortured and all the rest. If you look at what happened on an airliner landing in Detroit, just like with the Lee Harvey Oswald problem back in 63, literally several tens of thousands of media outlets said the same thing word for word. If you clicked between channels on cable, you would see that the same story appears at the same time with the same frenzy, with the same certitude, with the same arrogance. So that's why I wrote the article for the New American called The 60th Anniversary of Orwell's 1984, with some sensational disclosures that the experts on Orwell have not revealed in 60 years.
If you want some irony, I was reading that article while my son was getting completely foobarred in the hospital today from his reactions to anesthesia. And so I'm reading and highlighting your article while they're pontificating about, you know, what they're going to do to cover their butt for what they did to them. And I'm reading this, and I'm like, this is exactly what I'm literally having dinner theater as your article is being put in my head.
Why.
So thanks for that one. And again, anyone who doesn't know David's work with this, you have quite a history with 1984.
If you go on the omnipotent Google,
yes,
and type in David Goodman, Orwell's 1984, the article I'm citing is the third one down. But the articles go back to 1978. You can access, so I've been writing about this for over 30 years. Actually, I went public with it in 1974 and wrote an article for Human Behavior in 75. And in 78 did what was considered one of the 20 best papers ever written on 1984. That was in 1978 for the Futurist. So here I could be making, I don't know, at the local University of California campus, like all these years I could have been making $155,000 a year, and for working 10 months. I could have worked for some drug company, because I did start out at a drug company, making about $235,000 a year. I could be working for an advertising agency making over $400,000 a year because I devised a scanner, a body scanner, way back 30 years ago. And I could be scanning brains to see if people prefer Pepsi-Cola or Coca-Cola. And the money is virtually limitless. We're a two-level society. Either you're making $155,000 to $400,000 plus and on up, or you're making like I'm making. You called me a critic. So why did I put myself through this, talking about and writing about 1984?
Yeah, really.
To have like 43 publishers turn down my proposal to make public 137 predictions of Orwell in the book. If you go to the library and you look on the shelf for diets, you know, you find several hundred books in my library. But the fact that we're edging rapidly closer to 1984 is not even worth the $10,000 book advance. So I go back to what I said earlier. This is Goebbels' Germany in December 1944. Everybody's suffering. We're getting bombed 24 hours a day. We have the fear level is very high. Your phone rings. Friends have awful problems. What can you do for them? And here I've been writing about Orwell since 1974. That's 35 years. And what have I made, or anybody like me, made from being a critic of the pharmaceutical industry, of black operations, and so forth? I mean, you tell me, why do people do what I did when there's so much money to be made by playing along with the boys?
Well, again, this is, and if no one's tracked David's career, we've had him on the show a bunch of times, especially the night that Obama was elected, is that if given a choice, this is the ultimate, you know, sort of, you know, the devil, deal with the devil. Given the choice in the 60s, having the retrospective awareness of what's gone on since, of maintaining your training and saying, I'm all about promoting brain development, I'm all about health, mental health, and having the very institution that you've been raised to believe operated on the same level of integrity go at 180 and go, no, we're going to deal with mental illness and go the opposite way and get into pharmacology and then get into, as you say, I said before you got on the air, propagating what's been over a 30 or 40 year cultural lobotomy, as they've done things to the food and the drug supply and then the vaccines and everything else, and then this latest thing with H1N1. And now you start reading how, you know, some of these things have been used in biological weapons. Where does it end? So if you, knowing all this and saying, if you just go along with the crowd, you're going to get your cushy job, you're going to get your house, you're going to get your retirement, and if you don't, you're going to be vilified and you're going to be nailed to the wall at every turn. Hardly anybody, I would say probably you and maybe like five or six other pioneers with arrows in their back, you know, might have decided to take that rough road. But by taking that rough road and enduring and existing now as opposed to then, your message can get out. The article he posted up again, it's in it's on Google if you go there and get it, but it was published on the newamerican.com. And it does look back, and I was going to go through a couple of these points you know, towards the end of the show about what's gone on since this sort of distortion of what 1984, and I read it in high school. I read, you know, a bunch of those books, Brave New World, all these books, and they were really, the concept of dystopia is what we were always told in the Cold War is what the other guys were doing. And then once the Cold War was over, and Reagan said, you know, Gorbachev, put down that wall, you know, and it was like, it was weird because we didn't have enemies that we could see anymore. And then the enemy within started to rise up, and you started seeing how corporations started to bend the boundaries and create this sort of institutionalized stupidity that we see now everywhere. And then we've had, what, 15 years of dumbing down since the Internet came up and sort of overrode the television as a way to disseminate whatever you want to call it, information, misinformation. So how do you see, and we've had a bunch of people talk about the rise of social media, how do you see messages like yours that are not calling for, you know, riots in the street? They're calling for basically a kind of a heart-to-heart conversation with yourself. How do you see messages like this gaining traction in a society that's so drugged, so beat up, and so put into fiscal and systemic debt? How do you see this message propagating?
Well, there's 246 countries in the world, the last time I checked. We have a competitor, economic competitor called China. Stuff like mine could go nuts, could go crazy in China because they're suspicious of the United States and its new health care bill, by the way. We could talk about that in a while.
Yeah.
You've got India. You've got Brazil. You've got, like my field, Rhythms of the Brain. You've got Germany, you've got a good part of the European Union. Even Canada departs from America in some of its recent trends. So I think what has to arise is outside of the United States and would permeate or percolate back into this country. Of course, what I've always said is that the last couple of years, if a reasonable number of intelligent, scientifically trained women with religious background when they were younger, if we could elect 25 of them into Congress who have children between 17 and 19 years old who fight in our wars, this is the revolution, especially if they're independent thinkers. And then they would be receptive to what's going on in other countries as America goes into its free fall or continues its free fall. That's the way I look at it. Because I've spent on the Orwell project $20,000 of my own money because it was, as they say, a slam dunk. The world is interested in its inevitable decline. How many predictions have come true, Dr. Goodman, from your list of 137?
Yeah.
But we're so immersed in black operations by the government, the Goebbels-type operations. We're so immersed in the trillion-dollar drug industry in this culture that I really don't see how anybody other than these mothers of younger children, can lead us out of this mess. It's not going to be the older men like you and me. I mean, we're brainwashed. We've watched 2 trillion hours of television. We've read newspapers where the headlines are formulated in Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia. You know, it's got to be younger people. It's got to be younger people who see through this sham. So,
well, for the most part,
just saying,
when I was, Good. When I was dealing with the eighth grade kids, the eighth grade kids I was dealing with were very, very, almost to the point of being upset when I took apart their biology textbook in front of them and said, that is a book of biological history. What they're not giving you is all the neurobiology that's happened since before you were born that basically kind of overrides a lot of the stuff that's in this book, and that's what you're being tested on to see if you're competent in biology. That, it, for all practical purposes, stopped at about 1950 in this book. And here we are, you know, 2000, almost 2010, and this is the textbook that New York State says is the advanced biology textbook for all these kids. And when I showed them a little Bruce Lipton and I showed them a little bit about cell physiology, they were like, where is this stuff? And I said, it's not in elementary school, guys. It's all over the web, and you guys have to get to the point where you say, you know what? What is the school responsible for, and what am I responsible for if I really want to learn something here? And don't be a test taker. You know, be someone who has passion about knowledge and information. And since then, you know, it's kind of spiraled from there. The kids got curious because the YouTube culture can give them more in 3 minutes than somebody's textbooks can give them in 9 months. Because, again, the other thing that maybe you could speak to in terms of brains is that because we've become a much more visual culture, the art of reading is actually gone by the way the wind a little bit. People would rather watch a video than read something now. So do you think getting the sort of the hearts and eyes of these of this generation is going to come through that type of medium rather than through books and articles?
Well, it's going to come through teaching children the process of independent inquiry on their own. I have a peer review article I wrote for a journal called New Paradigm in Australia a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got to do with something called Consciousness 4.
Okay.
And it's some of that previews of Consciousness 4. A lot of people think that's the best article I've written on the internet, and yet it was just a toss-off. It was something I did called The Point Club back in 1960, Program of Organized Inquiry by the Neighborhood Teenagers, because they can see the truth. Like, I mean, for example, we tolerate ambiguities, we old men. I'm 70 years old, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm 45 as a Monday, so.
Yeah, well, you're old. Anybody over 47 to me is old.
Well, 45, I got 2 more years of being young.
These kids are supposed to be immersed in evolution, when they're eighth graders, okay? This is the dogma, and I think evolution is one of the most beautiful concepts I've ever experienced in my life, even though I'm a religious person. I just was looking at a book that was like 1,800 pages about modern experiments in evolution. The school nurse this is not happening in Stalin's Russia. This is not happening in Goebbels and Hitler's Germany. The school nurse is saying one out of three kids may have mental illness and may require medication. You tell me where psychiatry has any overlap with evolution. I thought it was survival of the fittest. How in the world can one out of three kids be mentally ill and dependent on an artificial substance for their very survival and to correct their, quote, imbalances, unquote, and to return to the dormant mainstream? I mean, doesn't anybody draw analogies? Doesn't everybody have a model of thought? Doesn't anybody challenge? I do in the article, by the way. Challenge the stupid psychiatrists?
Well, they become the priests.
The number of mentally ill kids is 1 in 1,200. That's a historical figure that goes back hundreds of years. How could it be 1 in 3?
Well, the line in your article that made me actually, as I'm sitting there watching what's happening to my son in front of me, you say towards the end of the article, in real life, the DSM-5, Diagnostic Manual, due out in 2012, ironically, sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association, APA, according to critics, comes close to pathologizing the entire American population, with government having taken full advantage of such expert opinion. Tens of millions of Americans could be placed on the mental illness watch list for just being moody and declared to be too active or inactive. So if we're heading there, while they're making all these reforms and mandating insurance, we're all basically going to be on this, we're all on the enemy's list, so to speak. Our brains literally are under suspicion. I mean, I was out in San Diego Harbor there a couple weeks ago, just minding my business. I was actually reading a book, and I was questioned because I was deemed a suspicious character because he hadn't seen me there before.
I see.
And that was the qualifications. You hadn't seen me, so I'm suspicious. I'm reading a book. So I was like, we're at the point now where the paranoia is so systemic and so omnipotent. And you're saying if the psychologist can see, once they diagnose you, this is another thing we talked about when we get to some of the issues about Homeland Security and definitely when we get to ClimateGate, when Douglas Mark calls in a minute, is that if you disagree with environmentalism, green behavior, so to speak, now you're unpatriotic. Now you look at it as a subversive. If you don't get your flu shot and you don't have that you know, the chip they're going to put in people's arms in up in Massachusetts, you're looked at as someone who is a public health hazard because you didn't get your shots. So we're now becoming the mice in the cage that supposedly in the land of the free, where the government is looking at us as sleepers. We're all sleepers. And we could pop at any minute. So that's why it makes sense to them in the distorted view of the world to take the grandmother and have her basically, take off her shoes and do a dance, and now we're going to go through body cavity searches and look through everyone's bags because there's going to be another jihadist on a flight from Amsterdam. So, right on cue, we have Douglas calling in here. See if that's him. Is that you, Doug?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right, so we now I really feel threatened. I've got David Goodman, the brain connoisseur out there in the West Coast, PhD par excellence, and I got Douglas Mott from literally a rocket scientist from the NASA Space Shuttle Program. And wow, I'm just a dopey chiropractor here on the second floor. So let's see if we can solve the problems of the universe between our three brains here before we go any further. So, Douglas,
that sounds like a plan.
Yeah. Okay. We got a little time. Now, you've read 1984, right? You read that book?
No, actually, I haven't.
You haven't read it? Oh, well, we got to get the audio version from David to read it for you. But you've experienced the side effects of it in your own field as the whole industry of space, and this is something that parallels what David went through with NIH, is that when did the space program become so corrupt by the corporatism and by the government influence that it couldn't foster creativity anymore, much as what happened in David's world in academia?
Well, I think with any bureaucracy, you're going to run to a point where you stalemate yourself. I mean, at the beginning, NASA's whole goal was beat the Russians to the moon. I mean, that was it. And given the Cold War, us versus them, red versus red, white, and blue mentality that the entire nation had at the time, it was pretty easy to get behind that horse and fund it and push it and make it happen. But then, of course, and you mentioned this earlier, as the wall came down and Russia was no longer this imminent threat or not as what it once was, the drive and focus for space kind of dwindled and got fractured, and NASA now does way too much. They have not learned how to shift responsibility to other sectors. They don't know how to privatize, even though part of NASA's mandate, if you read one of its founding, I don't want to say manifesto, but it's one of its founding lines, is that it's supposed to foster the growth and development of the commercial space industry. NASA is supposed to be the research and development arm of space and then pawn that off to the private sector because commercial business can't absorb the costs to do some of this extraordinarily expensive R&D, but the government can. And so they do the crazy Lewis and Clark stuff and then invent XYZ technologies and then pawn that off to the private space industry so that they can use it to go mine asteroids or build a moon base or whatever the case may be. And I think they stalemated themselves into this military paranoia complex where they think space is a national defense, homeland security issue, whereas it should be looked at as a frontier exploratory other location issue.
And again, this is we're in the midst of this economic sort of choice point. And David, again, you could chime in on this as well. How do we get the culture, which is very confused right now, and also forced because of circumstances to sort of think for themselves without having, as David says, the capacity to think anymore, because we're all mentally ill, how do we get the it's sort of the genie out of the bottle here, in a sense, because, like I said before, once the enemy went, you know, sort of into the ether, we couldn't see the enemy. The enemy was always the other culture. And now we have so many things that are embedded in our culture that cause us to have almost like a churning, sort of like almost like we're like a grated cheese of one crisis after another coming out of the fact that we've gone so far off the map. How do we get our education system and our economic system lined up with the principles that the that got us to the point where we were achieving so much before all this happened? And almost despite the Cold War, the creativity was still there all the way through, you know, I would say through the early 90s, but the thing was we couldn't apply anything. I said, well, we had all this brain research, but we didn't bring in it to education. We had all this innovation in engineering, but we used it for, you know, like what the government would do, the government cheese, they would use it for, like you say, the Lewis and Clark stuff. So, David, first, if we understood the real meaning of 1984, not as, you know, the Cold War stuff and the Stalin fear-mongering, but as this, as you say, this satire of taking that mentality and putting it into the Anglo-American culture and having it become, you know, this sort of shorthand, and that then the socialistic stuff comes out and all the moorings come off. How do we get that message across when both those systems, education and economic, are so fraught with corruption at this point that the underculture, the one that's coming up, that are given these carrots, like the same carrot you were given, by the way, in the 60s, are given the same carrots for the next bubble or whatever it's going to be. I think it's going to be carbon, by the way. How do we get them to not take the short-term prize for the long-term reward? So, David, first, and then we'll get Doug's take on it.
Well, I think that Barack Obama goes on television like John F. Kennedy did, what was it, 1963? And declares a national goal, this is the decade of the growing brain, that we go back to the educational techniques of 1960, of 1860, of 1760, of hierarchical growth of brain tissue and brain function. Instead of right brain, left brain, which is dialectic equivalence, has nothing to do with higher brain function, with human genius, the basic curriculum that we inherited in America is based on a tempo of brain growth. In other words, you take arithmetic first and advanced calculus last, because at each age, that was the capability of the brain. When you're 7 years old, you can do arithmetic quite well, and calculus is so abstract, it's beyond your capabilities. Mm-hmm. But by the time you're 19 or 20, except for me, calculus is well within your ken. So I think what the president has to do is declare a national goal where higher brain power returns, is restored, is integrated back into education at all levels. And I think that would include the emotional intelligence, the social intelligence, innovative intelligence, spiritual intelligence, all the things we've talked about. Mm-hmm. America's problems would be over within 4 years. That's what I believe.
Wow. Okay. So Doug, now applying that to your situation in terms of making the space and environment that we could expand into to remove a lot of the, as you talked about on your show back with us a couple of weeks ago, to make it an environment instead of competing or this flag waving contest, that we look at space as a resource for us to grow economically. How do we get that message across to these confused and mired individuals running around in the malls right now?
Right. I think the previous point was very well said, that Obama or some president, I'm not even sure if Obama has space on the radar at all. My solution is simple. If he were to state something to the effect of, we're going to go build a base on the moon for science and research purposes and for commercial purposes so that parts of it can be rented, leased, or used by the world, and it will be built by the world, it'll be a collaborative effort of all the major space agencies and private industry, the key component being and private industry, not just governments. But get the commercial sector in there to make a hotel part out of it, to make a private research lab out of it, and make a government research lab out of it. So that's part one. You tandem that with going to mine or do research for mining asteroids, which is a resource boon, because one decent-sized asteroid a metal one, has more iron ore on it than every amount of iron that's ever been mined in the history of humanity. So that's just one asteroid, has more material on it than what we've ever consumed thus far in our existence. So that's a major resource that could be economically viable. And then maybe research the possibility of going to Mars, but I'm a firm believer that the moon scenario teaches you a lot of lessons that you need to learn before you go off and try to do something to Mars. Unless we invent advanced major propulsion systems and shorten that trip to Mars drastically, then there are a lot of other issues that we need to tackle first before we just start sending people that way. But human exploration of space is vital not only for our mental expansion to learn stuff, to increase that brain power, to increase that thinking capacity, but it also serves as a target that young people can say, not if I study this calculus that's driving me nuts, if I study this stuff that may be challenging, I know that my reward is that I could go into space. Not that I could like do what I'm doing now, sit in a cubicle in the Boeing building and screw around all day long and not really touch it and feel it, but actually get to go there and do something. That is the next mental shift that needs to occur, to where space is no longer pervy to just the select few astronauts as appointed by the government, but that space is readily accessible by anyone who wants to go. And as the commercial industry develops and as those systems are developed and the infrastructure is developed, the costs will start to drop drastically, as in with every fledgling industry. It will mimic the same exact historical patterns.
So, okay, so back to David off of that point. If we're now creating a newtopia, I guess you can call it that, with Doug's point about using space as another environment that we could expand into, just like another new world in a sense, do you think we have right now in the generation that's coming through the raw materials, the creativity there, and say the 10 to 25-year-old range, that we could actually propagate that over the next, you know, 20 or 30 years, that by the time those kids are in their mid-30s, that Doug's vision would become a reality? Or are we still at the point where we have to kind of jumpstart the system because all those kids have been, you know, through the same basic indoctrination, if you will, allopathically and also, you know, from educational limitations, and we have like another generation to wait before things are going to change?
Well, I'm going to go back to a point I raised very seriously not very long ago. I just finished a nine-month consulting project on developing a Chinese herbal alternative to medicines that are used to treat Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it has a whole lot more testing to do, but I did come up with 8 Chinese herbs. This required that I read perhaps 2,000 to 3,000 different Chinese research papers, all in very good English, all very logically organized. I say all loosely. I mean, obviously, there's some bad papers. But I believe, and I think Doug would probably agree, that the Chinese are turning out 7 times more science graduates than we are. Some of the best graduate students in the United States come from China and the Europe and other parts, especially Korea. I mean, there's some marvelous papers I read from Korea. 85% of the papers I read came from outside the United States.
Wow.
So we just have to turn to some supranational group that doesn't have our imperialism and our jingoism and our chauvinism, and let this huge growth towards inner and outer space occur in another country as its primary site of action. It could even be Brazil. It's another thriving country. Why don't we just say America and its self-image, its ego, its career-mindedness has had its time, and it has to join the rest of the world now? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, would you guys both agree that the United States and basically that whole culture has become sort of third-world intellectual in the sense that we don't really reward, like some of the other countries that he mentioned, innovation and creativity and competence? We seem to reward, you know, compliance and you know, kind of get along, go along, and we don't really have a mechanism that like these countries have to, and the pressure on it, because they're smaller countries,
to basically take the wheel. We have sort of a much more of an open bus, just kind of just park yourself in the middle of the bell curve and go along for the ride and hope that you get a corner office. So, Doug, first, in your industry, do you see the same creativity that existed late 60s, early 70s when NASA was first getting its traction rising up again? Do you see that has to come from an international base, or can it come from this culture?
I think America is still the global space leader, but I don't think that the targets that we now have in our sights are one nation targets. I think we can be the leaders, but we can't do it alone. I think it's, first of all, I don't think it's a good idea to do it alone. I think it's stupid to try and go build a moon base or anything else alone. You know, it's a global economy, it's a global system, it's global communication. We are now getting to the point to where we are one Earth. Not nation. Yes, there's nations and borders, and boy, I could go on a whole different tangent on that. I mean, one of the things you guys are talking about is the system, the economics, and I think the monetary system as a whole is an outdated, old world way of doing things that was fine when resources were scarce in isolated locations. But now that we have the ability to transport goods and services anywhere around the world, anytime we want, with global communication on a dime, that system no longer works because there's really no scarcity anymore. Scarcity is manufactured scarcity. Scarcity Wow. doesn't truly exist. So if the system were to change, I think all of this would be a hell of a lot easier. But given the current system, the monetary system, fiat money, the economic cycles, the booms and busts, everything that we go through right now, global interaction is what will get us to the next level until we change the system.
All right. Well, that whole thing you just said was that scarcity is manufactured. Speaks to David's point of 1984-ish, and just it's wow. That kind of hit me right in the chest when you said that one. Just as a kind of a way to dovetail what happened the second half of this year, we came out of the summer healthcare debates, and we got into the swine fear season there, and then a couple of things happened. The flu crane crisis over there in Kiev I mentioned before, and then ClimateGate. And we had Doug on in the aftermath of ClimateGate. Now that we're post-Copenhagen and looking at the next year, again, this is your guys' deal, international cooperation, all these alliances, but the environmentalism movement and the flimsy, if to use a very light term, science that it's been based on and now it's been, you know, sort of picked apart, how do they put Humpty Dumpty back together again to make these policies that they, these tentative, non-binding policies that they came up with, stick? How do they do that when everybody kind of knows it's all based on a bunch of garbage?
Well, let's see.
Do you want to go first?
Let's get Doug first.
I'll be real brief. At the 2000 Neuroscience Convention, the speaker suggested that we solve problems and award $1 million to the person that solved a certain problem, not passing through faculty at all, not passing through peer review committees. Just be utterly pragmatic. And I think that would solve any number of America's problems in a bang. Because I'm not the Lone Ranger. Doug's not the Lone Ranger. There's
right.
tens of thousands of us who have credible, practical solutions, have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars of our own money, and then we have to deal with these nutcases, these Prozac freaks that take 8 drugs, 27 prescriptions a year working for government agencies, and they've got a fraction of the ability that we have, and I think that point was raised by Doug. Right, Doug?
Right.
So do you see that? I mean, what happened in Copenhagen as a sign that the emperor has no clothes and we're finally seeing through this stuff, or do we still like the puppet show?
I think Copenhagen was beautiful in that it showed how politics tried to overthrow science, or at least manipulate and control it. It started to become apparently obvious that some scientists were in the bag for a particular theory or a particular push, but that it was politically motivated. There were strings, there were puppets, you know, what do we say,
yeah.
the masters behind the puppets. And that's a great Metallica album. Anyway, so besides that, it started to become, and now that, as you said, the cat's out of the bag, real scientists, those of us who actually want to do proper research before we start jumping to conclusions, I have finally been able to step up and say, see, we told you that this was, you know, not necessarily bunk, but that the conclusions are way too abrupt too soon to say that humans are the sole cause and we need to pass global laws that severely, you know, threaten personal freedoms and everything else. So, you know, when it comes to that, and I think that's what Climategate enabled to be revealed and enabled legitimate scientists to step up and say, now let us do our work and try to come up with more reasonable solutions.
Yeah, it was scary for me because as someone who's been in the healthcare field for almost 20 years now, when you see the broad brush that was painted with H1N1, then you see the Tamiflu study come out where they literally lost the data that they drew false conclusions from to push a drug out there, and you see almost a million doses of the H1N1 vaccine down in Atlanta, 800,000 there and a couple hundred thousand scattered throughout the country come up with basically inert. And then you see what happened in Kiev and in Baxter Labs with some of these vaccines, the H1N1, were put in with H5N1, which basically neuters the kid. And that was propagated through all over Europe, a couple hundred thousand doses of that. They slipped that in. So the era of trusting Big Pharma, trusting the governments to protect these things, is sort of over. And that's why I don't see the solution coming from the institutions that are there now. They're sort of archaic. The commercial side is still, to me, so embedded in the corporate culture of, you know, find a weakness and exploit it, that I sometimes say, okay, you know, we're going to put all of our stock in you know, entrepreneurism and that kind of a thing, and make it the Wild West again. I'm not sure if that's going to be the way it's going to pan out. But I guess to just kind of get a take on it, just kind of put it into parentheses here, if you had to describe a healthy American, say, in 2020, as we get to 2010, I'll let David go first, what would be the redeeming feature of a healthy American versus a healthy human being? What is it about this culture that is going to be distinct from all cultures? Or basically, are we just going to go for the healthy human being here?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that properly. I do know I worked at Sloan Kettering Institute, and the study done by Dr. Winder that I worked for, a very world-famous epidemiological scientist, preventive medicine, showed that Seventh-day Adventists in Pomona, California, outlived their neighbors by 7 years. So the real question you should have asked at that time, and I've been tracking that since then, is, how could these people so outlive their neighbors when something like a statin may give you a few extra microseconds of life? And why don't we look at healthy people and draw credible conclusions about how it's possible to live a long life, even live to be 100 years old, without ever having an X-ray, a blood test, visiting a hospital, a clinic, even seeing a doctor. So what I'm saying is we should go back to square one and ask the rudimentary questions about what really makes people happy, even if it's politically incorrect to talk about it, and what makes people healthy. You know, my electrician came in here a couple of months ago, and he talked about a town in Mexico where there was an unusual amount of people living to be 100 years old or more. And yet, it's in the middle of the wilderness. It doesn't have any clinics. It's just we have the ability in us, if we don't get poisoned by toxins in the air and the food we eat and the soil, that we can live 100 years and a happy 100 years. So I'm all for looking at the preventive medicine field and not treating people with innumerable drugs whose interactions are unknown, whose ability to be toxified by the liver is also unknown, has never been tested on large populations for long periods of time. So my solution is to go back to the lifestyles that worked so well in the past and work so well in rural communities now around the world that aren't being poisoned. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Well, again, I'm going to bounce that off of Doug here in a second, because this goes back to Ivan Illich's definition of health that I told these eighth grade kids that made them sit back in their chair. He says health is the capacity to cope with the human reality of death, pain, and sickness. Not the most uplifting message in the world to give eighth graders, but basically, when you're told constantly that death is all around you, whether it's terror this or flu that or whatever, there's not a lot of feeling of safeness. I mean, you don't have that feeling of safety, you don't tend to evolve very well, because your system is going to go basically into survival mode. So, looking at all the things that you've been mentioning here, Doug, if we're sitting there in 2020 and we're looking at this healthy and proactive human being, what is it distinct about them that you would see looking forward that isn't there now? What will take the, to coin a phrase, we'll create a little David here. We'll remove what isn't David. What's there when you look at 2020 from your scope and saying, okay, what's missing that we could reveal that would make this person more vital, more healthy, more open, more fully developed?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Hey. Soft questions here in New Year's Eve.
Oh, geez. I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on how we start treating the human condition. I would go back to say, what's our environment like? Not environment as in trees and grass and stuff, but our social environment. How there's an awful lot of stress just to live today. And we've got all this technology that's supposed to be making our lives easier, but none of it's being used properly. And some technologies that do exist are causing detriment to the environment. So how do you come about creating new systems that achieve the same goal but don't have the negative side effects? I think a healthy person is one who doesn't throw every pill under the counter into their body. I think some manufactured drugs are unhealthy. I don't care what they say. I have never in my life had a flu shot. Never had one, never planned to have one, and even if I've had the flu in the past, I don't even remember if I have had it in the past. So, and I have a very strong immune system. I get sick maybe once a year. I have never broken a bone. I my dad always said, eat dirt, it's good for you, it'll make you stronger. And so, we've come to the point now, I think we've over-sterilized our world, that we don't even know how to combat the basics anymore, that our immune systems don't know how to fight off the simple things, because right when a child is a baby, they're squirted with everything under the sun into their system. Now, some of it I think is good and justified. Some of it I don't know. Some of it you can't even prove what the hell they're shooting in the kid in the first place. You don't know that is what is. So you can't prove that. So if you're looking at it in that way, limit all of the foreign stuff or the manufactured stuff that you're going to bring into your system. Now, I'm not saying being holistic and herbal and eat great nuts and life will be great. That's not exactly what I'm saying. I am a technocrat. I love technology. I think science and research and innovation in all fields is amazing and good for human longevity. But in some cases, it is abused and misused, and people need to learn what they should and should not put in their system.
All right, well, I'm just going to break in and tell the guys that are listening on the stream right now, we're going to be getting cut off in a minute from that, but we're going to go a little overtime. So you archivers are going to get the bonus couple of minutes here. But you streamers that are listening live, thanks for listening to Summertime. We're going to be back again on Monday night. Watch for a special Monday night broadcast with our friend NSM Doc and Sacromaniac. I'll check the server for that in a couple of days. It'll probably be about 6 o'clock New York time. He's going to be coming on talking about all the new stuff that's going on out in his world. In government intrigue and things like that. So we'll have him on Monday. But to wrap up with you guys here as we say goodbye to the streamers here, if I could just put my two cents in on this healthy human being concept, because I really feel like we've gotten past, just like you guys talked about before, all the dichotomies, the right and the left and all that stuff, and Soviet versus Anglo-American culture, all the things that were dividing us, can really be put in a common denominator here, as you just said before. We have one Earth, one planet. And to make it sort of like, again, to make it much more of a simple thing is that ultimately you have self and surroundings. So if you have an awareness of the education system, but you're not relying on it to get smart. If you have an awareness of government bureaucracy, but you don't rely on it to protect you. If you have an awareness of a healthcare system, but you don't rely on it to be vital and healthy your whole life, you don't get abused by it. You can't ignore it like a lot of the grape nut people you said do and try and live in the hills and drop off the radar and operate out of fear. And you can't revolt and constantly keep trying to beat the system down because it's a huge, huge, huge monster to try to, the monolith, actually, David talked about before, the omnipotence of Google. All these multinational corporations do is they give you the cheese, they give you the perceived sense of freedom, of choice, and then they have you, they trap you, they track you, they watch everything you do. And so the system is really designed to invite you in just like we do with roaches, like a roach motel, and then move you through the system and keep putting that carrot in front of you, whether it's the career choice or whether it's, you know, financial security, because they're the ones that can completely threaten you with no existence. Now, if the economy goes bazooey and we start getting into some of the other, you know, dark corners that both you guys are well aware of, a lot of this stuff goes out the window. But if you just teach people first-person authority, which is a semantics term, that we tend to give up sometimes congenitally right off the bat with the vaccines and whatnot, but we definitely do it on a social basis because we socially condition ourselves to rely on these big systems that absolutely are fraught with corruption and exploit every weak spot we have. So if we got people to be aware and be much, much more of a vigilant culture that didn't tolerate a lot of this crap, we wouldn't have these mountains of basically just noise to wade through to get to the truth. And so the 2020 person I see is someone who's aware of their own truth, self-evident truth, and isn't trying to evangelicize it to everybody else in 27 different directions in order to get some short-term positive gain, and they're much more interested in the inner world of being coherent so that the outer world can reflect that rather than trying to put the elephant in the phone booth, so to speak. And it begins, to me, in David's world, of understanding and appreciating and sort of, in a way, taking it as a very sacred thing to develop a human brain from cradle to grave and not interfere with it and not try to drug it to death and not try to teach it to be silent, not let it be emotional. Let it experience life fully, and then you have a human being that is actually able to understand all their dimensions rather than look at everything that is aberrant, doesn't fit in the bell curve, as some type of pathology, like he said in his article, that, you know, they're going to basically have us all thinking that we're on a mental health watch list in a couple of years with DSM-5. So I guess to kind of wrap up what we've been talking about here is both you guys are out there, on the edge of something and doing our bit here. And we're all sort of in trouble at the same time because we're not behaving. We're not going along with the flow. We have solutions. My world in social stress, David's world in brain health and looking at the culture from his unique and extremely rare vantage point, and Doug's work with being a space advocate. How do we three, misfits, cope with the fact that probably 99% of the people we come in contact with are going to perceive us as being Martians? How do we become, accessible to people when the message that they get over and over again is this, like I said in the email to you guys, this cacophony of information that they get with where everything from diet to exercise to lifestyle is so mixed and muddied, and we're trying to give a very clear message. I'm talking first-person authority. David's talking about brain health and development, and you're talking about space advocacy. How do we get something that's as pinpoint as what we're trying to say through the mud? I'll let David go first.
Well, I have a website.
All right.
it's called www.tomorrowwillcare.com.
Okay.
And the point I make is that there are five stages of neurological development. Not stages 1 and 2 are encouraged at the standard educational system, including the university. Once you go to 3, 4, 5, you're on the watch list, the gray list. You may even be blacklisted. If everybody in school learned the five stages of neurological development, we wouldn't have any of the problems we have. Obviously, being a neuroscientist, my first paper was 1962. Being a neuroscientist and one of the first members of Society for Neuroscience, I have utilize this five-stage growth model. And, you know, why should I be the voice in the wilderness? Why shouldn't every young person going through high school and college be more like me and less like the headline readers and the TV watchers and the couch potatoes? So I think that's the solution for a healthier society.
All right, so tomorrowwillcare.com, you can check out David's message there. And again, his article is up there right now, if I can maneuver here, on thenewamerican.com about 1984, a book that gets blown off because they push it through in high school and people just kind of read it and go, oh, that was a weird book. But the message is in there. What was it, 137 quote-unquote predictions? When you think about life in this country now, especially with the light of last weekend with the Christmas bomber and all the things that are going on, the fear and consumption machine is alive and well, and buckle up for tomorrow night.
It's an autocatalytic system. It just goes faster and faster.
Yeah, and stand by for the Super Bowl. Yeah, who knows what happens next? But Doug, just I guess to kind of sum it up, what is it that you can offer us to kind of put a button in tonight's the proceedings that we would say is your message? How are you going to get your message through the mud? Is it going to be through internet or is it going to be through, you know, working with people close to, one-on-one?
All the above. I'm a new media whore.
I love
Twitter. I love Facebook. I have a blog. I'll shamelessly self-promote my blog real quick. It's thespaceadvocate.blogspot.com. thespaceadvocate.blogspot.com. And what I do there is I talk about current events and relate them to space. I talk about everyday life related to space. I can relate anything to space just to show people that target is not as sci-fi and out of reach as they may think it is. I think Hollywood sometimes does a disservice when they try to make it so overblown and grand that people think that that's really what it's about. And so I try to make it more realistic and grounded. I'm trying to get into professional speaking. I'm going to try to do touring and go to conferences and go to events and bring people into the fold so that they can understand that. And it's not just space, it's technology. Technology is our solution. And I say this, that space helps develop the technologies that we can use right here at home. And so by going to such a far-off target, such a complex system, you end up developing technologies that help you right here at home to have cleaner energy, which then develops better systems to live and reduces stress on the human condition. And so by focusing it the energies that way, that's how we can get through the muddied water. And I think one of the best things to do is to try to unmuddy the water by just educating people in any way that we can about how the system is, how it's broken, things and things to watch for.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for contributing tonight. It was a wild program, and I'm not sure how much of the last 5 minutes is going to be on the archive because the switchboard just said waiting for host to call in. Yep, we're all still talking. So hopefully, usually it records, but the knowledge will be safe with us. Just thanks for sharing your ideas. It's a pleasure to get to meet you guys and talk on the program, and hopefully we'll find a reason to cross paths in 2010. So again, thanks for sharing tonight, and hopefully we'll solve all the problems of the universe before Friday.
Well,
all right.
Thanks,
Dr. Mark.
All right, guys. Take
thanks
care.
Thanks for having
good
living fun. Yeah.
We will talk soon. David, my friend, is always the best, and we'll keep pushing the envelope until it falls off the table one way or the other, right?
Moving ahead, I'm looking at a couple of really fantastic contracts for next year.
Okay. Well, we'll talk, and I might be heading out to the West Coast again a couple of times in the early part of 2010, so maybe we can actually meet face-to-face before it's all said and done.
Okay.
All right, take care. Uh-huh. Thanks again.
Okay, all right, take care. Bye.
Hey, guys. All right. I'm going to tie a bow on this, if you guys are there or not. But basically, before I want to get off the air tonight, I wanted to get you guys into the mood here for the new year. I don't know sure if this is recording or not, but I'm going to keep talking. We got a blue moon tomorrow night. Blue moon is the second full moon in the same month. Nothing to do with the song, but basically it has to do with the fact that when these cycles happen within the same month, it's very intense. And we have this is the first full moon of the winter. So we're dealing with a lot of things that happened from our past, the first cycle of the season, dealing with past fear. Couple that with a lunar eclipse that's going on tomorrow. First time in a while we have one of those. Wow, New Year's Eve blue moons are rare every 19 years. So last one was 1990. Remember where you were then. And the next one won't be until 2028. So you got that going for you. All right? Couple that with the fact that it's an Anto, intense full moon, so we're dealing with a little anger. So you got anger in the present, fear in the past, and you've got all this stuff culminating in a New Year's Eve type of scenario. So there you go for tomorrow night. So there's a little moon news for you before we sign off. And again, we definitely understand that. And that's why you've seen the Anto parade this week with everyone from Ivana Trump to Charlie Sheen to the bombers and everybody else getting that anger going, getting that froth going out there. So just, you know, tomorrow night, be safe, be sound, be aware. All right, so I'm going to play us out here. Monday night again, we're going to have NSM Doc on. I'll let you know. Look at the server. Probably 6 o'clock in the East. We'll make that clear as soon as I get word back from Doc himself. Well, for all those who contributed, and we only got the smattering of the guests, Bill DeMoss and Beverly Potter and Drew Oliver from microbes, the giantmicrobes.com, and Paul Gurko from the Merlin Project, and Jeremy Cucci from the Trend Hunter, and Eric Wallman, who was on Thanksgiving talking about socialnomics, and of course Douglas Millett, who was just on, and our friend Luis Miranda down there in South America, who was nice enough to come on and talk about all the stuff from ClimateGate. Thank you to all our guests in 2009 on Summertime. Looking forward to 2010. I have no freaking clue who's on next Wednesday, but I know that we're going to be talking NSM Doc on Monday, so I'll start from there. And for everyone else who had to endure what happened this year, I give you the police, a nice double entendre to take us out. If you guys are still listening, if this is still recording, we'll find out later on Summertime. To all those, I say, travel light through the darkness. And then we say, this will play. Be safe tomorrow night, peoples.
Spiral on, see you in 2010.